From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. The COVID-19 crisis in India is now the worst in the world. The number of cases and deaths continue to rise, and the country is no longer exporting its vaccines. And this is putting a strain on other countries and continents, including Africa. The continent accounts for 16% of the population, but only has received about 1% of the world's vaccines. NPR Global Health correspondent Nurit Eisenman joins us now with the latest. Welcome.
Hi.
How many vaccines does the continent need, and what was the original plan?
Right. So Africa has about 1.3 billion people. If you figure somewhere between 60% to 80% need to be vaccinated to achieve herd immunity, that's as many as 1 billion people. The problem is that, as you noted, Africa was all but shut out by wealthy countries buying up the first doses. So the plan that leaders there cobbled together is, okay, by the end of this year, cover between 20%, maybe even 30% of the population through the COVAX facility. That's that international buying platform that's co-led by the World Health Organization. And then another 15% of people were going to be covered with vaccine that the African Union, which is a coalition of African nations, had separately negotiated with various vaccine makers to secure. But at most, that's just 45% of people covered. And, you know, a lot of African governments are not in a great position financially to buy the rest. So it was already a difficult picture. And then the situation in India hit.
Yes, yes. Can you speak to how the crisis in India has thrown a wrench into Africa's vaccine rollout?
Well, pretty much all of the first doses that COVAX, the international platform, was planning to send to Africa this spring was going to come from a manufacturer in India, Serum Institute of India. But because India's need for vaccine quickly became so huge, they're no longer exporting. So already there are 40 million doses that Africa was counting on for March didn't arrive. Another 50 million doses for April haven't been delivered. And it's already clear that the holdup is going to continue at least through May this month. Meanwhile, I mentioned the African Union had worked out its own deal to get vaccines. Well, about a third of that was also going to come from Serum Institute of India. So you have a situation where the amount of vaccine that was planned for Africa wasn't enough, and then very little of that insufficient quantity has actually reached the continent.
There's also something else. At the same time, some countries in Africa have had to throw out doses that have expired. How does that square up with the need here?
Absolutely, yeah. And we should, of course, note that there are African countries that immediately used up all the doses they were sent, Rwanda, mm-hmm. Ghana. But quite a number of countries have been slow to get those few paltry shots that they received actually into people's arms. Some of those doses were close to the expiration date. So, for instance, Malawi and South Sudan have already discarded tens of thousands of doses that expired. Democratic Republic of Congo says it will give up 1.3 million doses. And it really points to the challenge for a low-income government of mounting a complicated vaccination campaign when they're getting the doses in this haphazard, stop-and-start way. No reliable sense of what's coming and when, how much outside money they can count on to prepare the logistics. And then adding to that, these particular doses were all AstraZeneca vaccine. And shortly after they reached Africa, the news emerged of the rare blood clot cases associated with that vaccine in Europe. That made a lot of people in Africa very hesitant to take the vaccines, really slowed things down.
Okay, so like other places around the world, there's an issue of vaccine hesitancy. What more can be done to address that there?
It just really drives home how when, you know, it's not just enough to ensure that African nations get their fair share of vaccine. It's also going to be crucial to ensure that there's enough resources for the delivery side, which includes a lot of outreach, leaders speaking out, radio call-in shows, health workers maybe even going to door to door. That costs money, and there's a lot of concern that there's not enough money being raised for that piece of it.
Nurit, I have only about 30 seconds with you, but is what's happening in India creating a sense of urgency in Africa based on your reporting?
Yeah, you know, before India's situation got so bad, there was this widespread sense that countries, not just like India, but many countries in Africa had been spared the worst effects of COVID because the population's on the younger side, life is lived outdoors, theories like that. India's experience suggests it's more a matter of sheer luck and timing, new variants possibly emerging. And for African leaders, that is a terrifying prospect because when they consider if what happens in India were to occur in Africa, you know, their hospital facilities and oxygen supply is even mm-hmm. more limited. So they're frankly terrified.
Yeah. NPR Global Health Correspondent Nurit Eisenman, thank you so much.
Glad to do it.
A small change to the World Health Organization's website this month didn't make many headlines, but maybe it should have. The updated guidance explaining how COVID-19 spreads emphasizes tiny respiratory particles called aerosols instead of the heavier droplets. Didn't we know that already? Let's bring in Zeynep Tufekci. She teaches at the University of North Carolina and wrote about the changes in the New York Times recently. Zeynep, welcome back.
Thank you for inviting me again.
So the WHO made this change recently, along with the CDC here in the United States. Was it based on something new, or were they just catching up to what, frankly, many public health experts had already been saying about aerosols for months now?
I would say it was more of a catching up. In fairness, they had already started updating their public-facing advice, but they hadn't completely acknowledge what the science had been telling us for a long time, which is that these tinier particles that can float seem to be a major driver of transmission compared to the heavier ones that do fall relatively quickly. So it does really put last year in context in terms of what happened and what we could have done.
If it was a catch-up, why did it take so long to do so?
It's a very complicated history. Part of it goes back all the way to the origins of germ theory, where people used to fear that miasma, which is just noxious, smelly, stinky air, was bringing in disease even from really long distances. And scientists had to fight a long time to try to convince people that the really stinky air that makes you sick to your stomach isn't making you sick, but this clear glass of water you're drinking is what's giving you cholera. You can imagine that's not really intuitive. So they really had to fight the idea that just air itself was a problem. They focused on germ theory. But along the way, they did a few mistakes where they thought because most respiratory diseases transmit at close contact, still true for COVID-19 too, they just assumed it was things people sprayed out of their mouth and just kind of fell because they were really heavy, rather than just figuring out, yeah, they're these floaty things, even at close contact, that's what's getting you. That also means that since they're not immediately going to fall necessarily, if you're indoors in an enclosed space over time and people are doing something that produces more of those particles, like singing or yelling, that 6 feet is no longer as protective. So that was kind of the mistake they did along the way. But when we started seeing things that didn't fit the droplet theory, we were seeing, super spreader events. We were seeing transmission at a distance. They perfectly well fit the idea that these small little floaty things would be doing this. So then the challenge came back and saying, look, it's time to correct this. And as it so happens with these things, it's hard to change what people have believed their whole life as scientists. So it took a little too long, but I'm glad we're there.
Well, it took too long, probably also because scientists also pride themselves on the fact of getting things right. Couldn't you defend the WHO and the CDC here for making sure that they got it right?
I would say the evidence was fairly strong by last spring. And in July, 239 scientists signed an open letter essentially saying you have to take airborne transmission into account. You have to address it. Look at all this evidence. I think what's amazing is that we do make this much progress despite, having us, human beings be in charge of it.
Well, now we humans are clearly still focused on things like sanitizing surfaces. Do you think the outcome of this pandemic would have been different or even better had the WHO and the CDC come out and made these changes to their guidance earlier?
I think it's fair to say that if we had focused more on ventilation and moving outdoors whenever possible or opening windows earlier, and redirected some of our resources from disinfecting, that would obviously be better. And I do want to say something aerosol scientists have been saying to me for a long time is that plexiglass barriers may even make things worse by impeding ventilation and sort of creating dead spots where these little floaty particles can accumulate. And we spent so much money putting them up in schools and other places. And there's an article in Science just this week that shows that masks for teachers is associated, for example, with much better outcomes, but plexiglass barriers is associated with actually higher risk of COVID-19-like disease. So there's a lot of things that we might be doing that might even be counterproductive that we need to look at in this new light, because getting the mode of transmission wrong, not only does it impede us from doing the right thing, which is moving outdoors earlier. I mean, we might have made things worse by shaming people for being at the beach, closing parks, while spending so much money and effort disinfecting. But we're here now, so the important thing is to try to move forward as best we can.
Zeynep Tufekci is an associate professor at the University of North Carolina. She's also a columnist for The Atlantic and The New York Times and publishes a newsletter at theinsight.org. Thanks for your insights, as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you for talking with me.
You've probably heard this theory. People are not going back to work because they can make more in unemployment benefits if they stay home. Well, those disappointing jobs numbers we learned about last week have sparked a partisan debate about this unsubstantiated claim. Republicans in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce argue the $300 a week in federal unemployment benefits have incentivized people not to work. Well, President Biden yesterday weighed in.
I know there's been a lot of discussion since Friday's report, that people are being paid to stay home rather than go to work. Well, we don't see much evidence of that.
And on the state level, the debate over public health versus the need to rev up the economy also continues. Mississippi and Arkansas are the latest red states ending these extended unemployment benefits early. And in a moment, we'll get to the view of what that decision could mean for the people of Arkansas with the director of social services at the Salvation Army in Little Rock. But first, let's bring in Andrew Stettner, who is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. Andrew, welcome back to Here and Now.
Good afternoon.
So let's lay out some facts. We're still about 8 million jobs short of pre-pandemic levels. Only about 266,000 were created in April. What is the actual data on why people weren't employed last month?
Well, the good news is that people are, in fact, looking for work. And, you know, there are just still a lot of barriers, you know, to that happening. You know, women have some of the lowest employment rates. We have many states where the vaccine penetration, you know, is still, you know, getting there. So we have a lot of things in the way of a full recovery.
Well, let's break down some of the reasons. Economists at Yale who studied extended unemployment benefits last year found no evidence they prevented people from returning to work. However, there are these anecdotes floating around that there are people whose benefit checks were larger than what they were earning on the job. And some employers have said they have not been able to find workers. What's going on here?
Well, you know, as the president said, if you're on unemployment benefits and your old employer calls you back to work, with very few exceptions, you have to go back to that job. But many of the employers, you know, that are struggling right now, you know, they're in what we call the kind of low wage and low end part of our labor market. You know, in surveys, for example, of restaurant workers found that many people left that sector during the pandemic, not just because of public health, but because the tips weren't very good. So I've done focus groups and people have told me the same thing. You know, I went to take care of someone in their home. Because that was a minimum wage job, but it just felt a lot safer. Now the restaurants want to hire people again, and the workers that they did that work don't necessarily want it. Trucking is similar. It's a very kind of poor quality job. Quite frankly, you can't work at a restaurant and make ends meet if there's not affordable childcare available, you know, for you.
Yes, let's speak to that just a little bit more. How much does the shortage in childcare factor into all of this?
Well, I think when you're seeing women's employment really being the lag here, you know, we have to, you know, recognize that we're not going to fix this. And I think that's why it's so important that these federal pandemic unemployment benefits were scheduled, you know, to go through, you know, Labor Day. schools are going to be reopening. And we know that summer childcare is the worst time of year to find childcare because everyone needs it. And, you know, the centers have trouble finding staff themselves at that time. So when you're short 8 million jobs and you have 16 million people on unemployment benefits, you can't expect people to get back to work overnight. People need to search for work, find the right fit, you know, for their skills and aptitudes. What these governors are doing is kind of throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Well, there's so many states, though, that are now taking this action to phase out their unemployment benefits. We heard that Mississippi just yesterday is the latest. The governor there actually said, "It has become clear to me that we cannot have a full economic recovery until we get the thousands of available jobs in our state filled." I mean, this is up against the public health crisis that we're dealing with. Can you speak to that? I mean, is ending extended benefits going to solve that problem in the long haul? What I'm hearing from you is no.
You know, it's not going to magically create more jobs. There's simply not enough available jobs, you know, for all the workers, you know, that are out there. And, you know, we just have to call things like they are. In some of these states, unfortunately, you know, you have white governors, largely black populations, the majority, you know, 66% in Mississippi on unemployment benefits are black. People want people to take poor jobs immediately. You know, I will guarantee that if these benefits are in place, the economy will continue to recover and jobs will continue to get filled over time because people, you know these benefits are temporary in nature. Let's let people one by one, 10 by 10, you know, find jobs and allow the economy to recover over the summer.
Andrew, before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit, though, about Montana's approach and your thoughts on it. The state's unemployment is at 3.8%. That's near pre-pandemic lows, according to the governor there. Instead of unemployment, Montanans who accept a job will receive $1,200 in return to work bonuses. Is that an approach that makes sense to you?
You know, I think we know from the evidence that these reemployment bonuses have very little impact on the margins on people's decision, you know, to return to work. When they cut off these unemployment benefits, there's no support for people until they find a job. And that's going to put pressure on individuals. You know, Montana has the fifth highest Native American population in the country. That's one with a very high unemployment rate. Now that support is gone, you know, for that community. So we can't think of just the state. We have to think about populations that are hardest hit within these states.
Andrew Stettner is a senior fellow at the Century Foundation. As always, thank you so much, Andrew.
Thank you so much, Tanya. Great to talk with you.
Let's bring in Matthew DeSalvo, who is the director of social services at the Salvation Army in Little Rock, Arkansas. And Matthew, you just heard what we talked about. What's your perspective? What's the biggest reasons why people who come to your organization for help are struggling?
Well, I think the big thing is just there's a lack of resources in general in communities where people are in need in terms of needing mental health treatment, physical health treatment, you know, just resources in general to be able to get the things that they need to move forward. And then there's also just a lack of resources when it comes to places where you can have gainful employment. You know, we're seeing during the pandemic, businesses are shutting down, closing their doors. So it makes it really hard for people whose lives have been completely upended by the pandemic in terms of having children at home instead of being at school. The money that they're receiving right now just isn't enough. And I think the money that they were receiving before in their job wasn't enough either.
This is an interesting point that you bring up, that the money that they're receiving in unemployment benefits, that doesn't necessarily cover the cost of living, and neither did their previous jobs. Can you speak to the people that are coming to you, the situations that they're in?
There's just a variety. You know, it could be that, you know, they were laid off from their previous job and now they're, you know, in need and it's impossible to get ahead because they were already behind and this is just kind of snowballed. It could be that there was a pre-existing condition that kept them from being able to work during the pandemic. It could be that they're taking care of a couple different family members that are vulnerable populations during the pandemic. And that's taken that kind of main breadwinner in the house and brought them into being just a full-time caregiver. There's just a variety of different needs out there.
Matthew, for those who are wanting to return to work, what are the calculations people are making between balancing the benefits and returning to work?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that question, because you still are going to have children or people you're taking care of in the home that are still, you know, full-time online students. So how do you balance that? I think there's also what opportunities are actually out there in terms of employment. You know, like I know we mentioned restaurants, you know, are people coming in? Are, you know, the tips going to be fair? My previous employers didn't really take care of me. Are these people going to be different? There's just so many questions to that, and there's so much uncertainty. But those are just kind of a few of the ones that we've run up against. It's just a cost-benefit analysis.
What are you bracing for as we move through the next few months?
The moratoriums being lifted on eviction notices and the disconnect notices being sent out from utility companies. Is there enough money out there to go around? And the answer is no. So we have to be really good stewards of the funds that we have to be able to help people just move towards some sort of level of sustainability and just help them get back on their feet.
This has become a political conversation, but you're dealing in the day-to-day with everyday people who are mm-hmm. struggling. What's the message that you'd like for politicians to hear as they factor through how to handle unemployment benefits?
Well, I'm not necessarily going to speak to politicians. I'll speak to the general public. It's just listen. Just take the opportunity to hear stories, to listen to the stories that we're collecting here at the Salvation Army, and just know that these are real people with real needs in a real life situation. And just know that those are giving people hope. These organizations like the Salvation Army have the opportunity to give people hope.
Matthew DeSalvo is the Director of Social Services at the Salvation Army in Little Rock, Arkansas. Matthew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good question.
That's a really good question.
It's a great question.
This is free therapy.
Thank you for asking me that.
God, that's such a good question.
That's an interesting question.
But what Fresh Air interviews are really about are the interesting answers. Listen and subscribe to Fresh Air from WHYY and NPR.
Tom Cruise is returning his Golden Globe Awards. The three-time winner has joined the Hollywood industry in distancing himself from the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, the nonprofit that votes and runs the yearly award show, over allegations of corruption and a lack of diversity. And now NBC has announced it will not be airing the Golden Globes in 2022. For the latest on this, we're joined by KPCC entertainment reporter John Horn. Hey, John.
Happy to be with you.
Yes. So NBC's decision could actually put the future of the Golden Globes in jeopardy. This is one of Hollywood's oldest awards. What's their reasoning?
Well, I'd love to say they were taking the moral high ground by boycotting the Golden Globes because the Hollywood Foreign Press Association has zero black voters and a long history of illegitimacy. But the real reason is more obvious, and that is no one was going to attend next year's show. And that left NBC with essentially a celebrity-free celebrity show. Amazon, Netflix, Warner Brothers, HBO, and actors like Scarlett Johansson and Mark Ruffalo all pulled out, as did filmmakers like Ava DuVernay and almost all of the most powerful PR firms. Of course, most of those people enabled the Golden Globes in the past for decades, but that's maybe a different story.
It's important, though, for you to mention all of those names, because there's been a campaign going over the last few months since this Los Angeles Times report earlier this year that found the organization, as you said, had no black members, as well as several other allegations. What has the Hollywood Foreign Press Association done since these allegations have come to light to address some of the issues?
Not enough. I mean, the HFPA said it was going to try to diversify its membership, but the details seem pretty random and not nearly good enough for a lot of people. And last week, the HFP announced a plan for what it called sweeping reforms, but nobody in Hollywood liked it, except, it must be noted, NBC, which initially applauded the deal. The HFPA had brought in a diversity consultant who promptly quit, and then its former president, Phil Burke, likened Black Lives Matter to a, quote, racist hate movement. So they were not doing anything right.
NBC has aired the Golden Globe since 1993. We know that this year, ratings for the show plummeted to their lowest level since NBC started airing it. Only about 6.9 million people watched. Is this just confirming what has already been suspected, that this ritual of sitting down at home to watch award shows might actually be a relic of the past?
Yeah, I think so. And I think the pandemic has kind of accelerated that. I mean, a virtual show, though, is not nearly as good as a real show. And I would argue, you know, the Oscars and the Golden Globes once offered something you couldn't get anywhere. And that was like access to celebrities in real life. And thanks to paparazzi and now social media, you know pretty much what all of your most favorite celebrities are doing 24/7. So the idea of getting to see a glimpse of these people in public has gone away because of social media. And there are just way too many award shows. So if the Globes went away, which I think a lot of people hope they do, that would not necessarily be a bad thing. And it might actually benefit legitimate shows like the Academy Awards.
That's KPCC entertainment reporter John Horn. As always, thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Tokyo Olympics are supposed to begin in a little over 2 months, but Japan is dealing with a fourth wave of COVID-19 infections. It's so bad, the Olympic torch relay was pulled off the streets of Hiroshima today, and the government has extended a state of emergency for Tokyo and other areas until the end of May. The pandemic already forced the postponement of the 2020 Games, and our next guest says Japan should make the same decision this year. Sally Jenkins is a sports columnist for The Washington Post. She's on Skype. And Sally, if you were a part of the Japanese delegation going to the International Olympic Committee trying to make this case, what would you say?
Well, my case would be, you know, let's give everybody, the countries, the athletes, the hosts, breathing room. It's not engraved in stone that the Olympics have to be held this year or even next year. Why don't we get a grip on this global pandemic before we start trying to hold a gargantuan festival of 15,000 people from different nations descending on one host city? That's just insanity in the midst of a pandemic that's still absolutely raging like a wildfire through many of the countries that would want to send delegations.
But isn't this about more than just the pandemic? You write in your recent column for the Washington Post that Japan didn't surrender its sovereignty when it agreed to host the Olympics, but that's what seems to happen when a host city signs a contract with the International Olympic Committee, because the demands on that host city, whether we're in a pandemic or not, are incredibly high, to say the least.
One of the things that has been more and more apparent over the last couple of Olympic cycles is that the IOC really presents onerous contract terms to the host, to the point that no cities anymore are really willing to do business with them. You know, they really only had a couple of bidders for the games that wound up in Los Angeles, and LA's mayor was able to actually drive a pretty good bargain with the IOC. The leverage now is with the host cities, because they recognize the IOC understates the cost, understates the risk, and dumps all of the burden for financing the games on host countries and host cities, and then hoards the lion's share of revenues through licensing and media rights and so on. And so what Los Angeles did was say, well, you're going to have to pay us $300 million off the top, and you're going to have to make some significant economic concessions to us if you want Los Angeles to take on this burden. And that's an attitude that I think any prospective host country from now on should take with the IOC. For years, the IOC developed this sort of patina of power. They behave almost like a nation itself, and they're not. They're an organization of a handful of officials that live in the Palace Hotel in Lausanne, Switzerland.
So in that, are you making the case then that if Japan wanted to do something here in terms of a postponement or, you know, even in the unlikely case of a cancellation, that in fact they have leverage to get concessions from the IOC?
Their first obligation should be to their own national interest, not to a handful of Olympic sponsor companies. That's number one. And some of the pressure driving Japan is fiscal. But my point is, where is that contract enforceable? What court would look kindly on the IOC forcing an unwilling host nation to host 15,000 international visitors in the middle of a pandemic? I mean, that would absolutely ruin the reputation of the IOC. And so Japan has more leverage than it may imagine.
What do you think the future of the Olympics really looks like at this point? You mentioned that cities have started saying no to the IOC demands, or if they say yes, like Los Angeles did, that they're getting concessions. Do you think that it could ever just be a modest production that isn't overrun with excess costs, that just focuses on the sport and the athleticism of people around the world? You know, does it have to be so extra?
I think the IOC is at a real fork in the road. They are either going to go in that direction and reform the infrastructure of the games, and also they're going to have to make more financial concessions. That's one fork that they can take, or the other fork that they can take is the one they are currently on, which is to increasingly just go to countries ruled by strongmen, where, for instance, you know, Xi Jinping in China can spend limitlessly for his own prestige and can use forced labor to get some of these projects done. That's the other fork in the road. Increasingly, the only people that the IOC has a really good chance of getting acceptance from are Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. Is that really the direction we want the Olympic Games to go? I mean, that's the decision the IOC needs to make.
Sally Jenkins is a sports columnist for The Washington Post. We're going to link you to her column about the Olympics in Tokyo this summer at hereandnow.org. Sally, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The Biden administration is restoring protections against discrimination in healthcare based on sexual orientation and gender identity. The change reverses a Trump administration policy that said federal anti-discrimination provisions did not apply to transgender individuals. And while it's unclear how this policy will affect state laws, many legislatures are moving forward with anti-transgender bills. That includes Texas, where a group of bills would ban critical healthcare for transgender kids and teens. Houston Public Media's Sarah Willa Ernst reports.
Indigo Giles came out as gender non-binary around age 14, meaning Giles goes by they-them pronouns and doesn't identify strictly as a boy or a girl. They were in high school in Houston at the time and dealing with clinical depression and anxiety. A big part of that had to do with gender dysphoria. It's a medical term to describe the feeling of distress when one's gender doesn't match their sex assigned at birth.
I hate that I look like a woman. There's just times where I would look in the mirror and I feel like I couldn't recognize myself. Like, this isn't who I am.
Giles started wearing a binder, which didn't do much to flatten the appearance of their chest. And soon they started to consider top surgery or breast reduction. The process required multiple medical and psych evaluations, plus there were some delays. Giles was struggling with mental health when the surgeon pushed back the date.
I couldn't stop crying. And I was like, I gotta get it together. I have a pre-calculus quiz next period.
Giles finally got the breast reduction at 17, and it provided significant relief to their dysphoria.
Oh my gosh, it was like magic. And my parents have talked about this. They could see the weight lifted off of me. I immediately felt better.
But the kind of surgery Giles got would be banned by a slate of bills in the Texas legislature, as would puberty blockers and hormone therapy prescribed for gender transitioning. One bill by Republican Senator Bob Hall would strip physicians of their licenses or liability insurance for providing this type of care. He says minors aren't capable of making decisions this big.
We don't let children get tattoos, smoke tobacco, drink alcohol, use a tanning bed, get a concealed handgun license, buy spray paint, or vote. Why then would we continue to allow children to be prematurely mutilated by chemicals or surgery?
A few other bills would charge parents with child abuse if they consented to this care. Bills seeking to ban trans health care for kids have been filed in state legislatures across the country this year. And that's despite the advice of medical societies like the American Academy for Pediatrics and the Pediatric Endocrine Society. Dr. Aliza Norwood treats adults with dysphoria in Austin. She says trans youth who can't socially or physically transition are at a high risk of suicidal thoughts or attempts.
When they say it's life-saving, it means their child was miserable, so miserable, in fact, that they were thinking about ending their lives.
She says these decisions should be made by kids, families, and healthcare professionals.
It's basically like, to be blunt, uninformed lawmakers superseding guideline-based, evidence-based practice.
Other questions, members? Representative Smith.
Which many lawmakers on the House's Public Health Committee admitted to.
On a lot of this, because it's not something that many of us have had very much experience with.
During the hearing, lawmakers questioned Dr. Ximena Lopez, one of the few physicians in Texas who provides trans care for youth. Representative Reggie Smith asked her about a creeping suspicion some lawmakers have, whether there's a financial incentive for these clinicians to continue this care.
We're actually losing money. All these clinics in the country are losing money. We don't do this for the money. We're helping kids.
Kids and adults that have been sharing their stories, not just this session, but according to Ricardo Martinez with Equality Texas, past ones too.
We think about this as a bathroom bill 3.0.
The advocacy group has tracked over 30 anti-LGBTQ bills filed this session in Texas, compared to 19 in 2019.
Yeah, I mean, trans folks have been targeted before, but this escalation, it's something new.
Three bills have been voted out of committee. One of them has been passed by the Senate and is moving on to the House. For Here Now, I'm Sarah Willa Ernst.
Fans of Martha Wells probably already know the author is out with a new murder bot novella called Fugitive Telemetry. The book hit the New York Times and USA Today bestseller list less than 2 weeks after publication. Readers are drawn to Wells' misanthropic but lovable hero, first introduced in the Murder Bot Diaries series and follow-up novel Network Effect. The books have won a Hugo and a Nebula, two of science fiction's highest awards. Here and Now, producer Emiko Tamagawa spoke with Martha Wells about her cranky creation, and she has this story.
Science fiction often portrays artificial intelligence in one of two ways. There's evil AI. Think HAL in 2001, A Space Odyssey. HAL is a computer who stops obeying orders from humans so it can kill them.
Open the pod bay doors, HAL.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Then there's good AI, like Data in Star Trek The Next Generation, the android who is overcome with wonder at the simplest of human abilities.
Marvelous. How easily humans do that. I still need much practice.
Murderbot doesn't fit into either trope. This AI has a human face and shape. A layer of skin covers its mechanical and organic parts. But no sex organs. They're not necessary for its job. Murderbot is a security unit, or SEC unit, in a future where corporations dominate space exploration. Companies lease them as bodyguards. But even though they're self-aware and have emotions, SEC units aren't trusted. They're considered dangerous. Companies install governor modules to punish or kill SEC units if they step out of line. But Murderbot has a secret. It can step out of line when it wants to, but what it wants to do isn't violent.
I could have become a mass murderer after I hacked my governor module, but then I realized I could access the combined feed of entertainment channels carried on the company's satellites. It had been well over 35,000 hours or so since then, with still not much murdering, but probably, I don't know, a little under 35,000 hours of movies, serials, books, plays, and music consumed. As a heartless killing machine, I was a terrible failure.
That's Kevin Free, reading from the Audible version of All Systems Red, the first of Martha Wells' Murderbot Diaries, published by Recorded Books.
What I was going for was what an AI would actually want to do as opposed to what a human might think an AI would want to do.
And that's Martha Wells, who says Murderbot's media binging also helps it protect humans, even though it can be quite cranky when those humans are stupid and reckless.
When Murderbot gets put in these different situations of having to make plans and strategies and having to rescue people, it does tend to draw on things it's seen in the media because it's seen all that stuff in the adventure shows it watches.
Media also provides distraction for Murderbot. Years of being at humans' beck and call while also being treated like a terrifying killer have made it anxious and depressed, as well as irritable. And there is a mass murder in its past, something it only vaguely remembers, but enough to call itself Murderbot and to use entertainment as a way to cope. Murderbot shares that coping mechanism with creator Martha Wells.
I dealt with depression and anxiety all my life, and it's such an escape. It was very easy for me to imagine a being like Murderbot that has basically been mentally tortured and is in these terrible situations, finding that resource and falling into it as a way to stay sane.
Staying sane by consuming large quantities of media sounds a lot like pandemic binge watching. Murderbot's relatability appeals to NPR Books' Petra Mayer.
I love Murderbot for a whole lot of reasons. For one thing, it's more human than a lot of humans I know. But I think Murderbot really speaks to everyone who's ever felt like they had to hide who they were, that they had to put on a face to just survive in society. I mean, that's something that I think almost everyone can relate to in some level or another.
Martha Wells says Murderbot can teach humans a lesson in resilience.
It's been a victim, and it's been very vulnerable, and it still is to a large extent very vulnerable. But it doesn't let the things that have happened to it stop it from continuing to try to survive and continuing to basically enjoy its life.
And the rogue sec unit will continue to enjoy its life. Martha Wells has at least three more Murderbot books planned to follow Fugitive Telemetry. For Here and Now, I'm Emiko Tamagawa.
And we've got an excerpt of Fugitive Telemetry. It's at hereandnow.org. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.